Hello, I'm Peter Gilchrist.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton.
We're on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We'll be talking to historians, producers, and Scotland's finest to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're taking a look at the people that revolutionised Scotland's cuisine.
We'll be diving back into the 19th century and talking to today's food champions.
It's time to investigate our great Scots.
And so, the end is near. It is the last episode of season two. How are you feeling, Lindsay?
Good. I feel like we've been at it for a while. We've done what, 12 episodes, which it feels like quite an accomplishment.
This will be number 12. We have not held ourselves to a stringent timeline.
No, but I do feel like we are new at the podcast game and therefore aren't running to a tight schedule at the moment, but two, we wanted it to be good. So we had a couple of weeks where we were waiting for guests or you know, things didn't exactly follow a schedule, but I think we still were fairly regular.
Yeah, sure. I think, and the act of being like a creator with self-care, we did not place ourselves on undue pressure, but I think we've got a good series out of it. We thought today, instead of doing another deep dive into an aspect of Scottish food history, we could actually talk about where Scottish food is just now, and there's no one better for that, then our two guests are joining us today, Kelly and Rosalind from the Scran podcast.
Yes, and I'm sure many of our listeners are aware of the Scran podcast. Some of you might have even come to us via the Scran podcast because we spoke to Kelly and Rosalind earlier in the year about our tea symposium and they did a wonderful episode about featuring some of our speakers. So please go and check that out. But yeah, I mean, Scran's amazing. They've spoken to so many people. They've been up and down the country. They've done it all, so we thought, yeah, get them on board and pluck their brains for some podcast knowledge and just have a blather about Scottish food.
Yeah, and in this we talk about Scotland's food systems, we talk about the relationship between Scotland and Irish food, we talk about what we think needs to change in Scottish food going forward, and yeah, I think it's a really interesting chat about where's food is just now. So let's jump in to our conversation with Kelly and Rosalind. Welcome to the Scottish Food History Podcast.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
It's nice to come to you guys. Seems we're always like labouring on it, you guys to come on with us. So
we hate to talk about ourselves and our history practices. No, you've been very generous with your mic time. But yeah, this would be a great opportunity to turn it around and also just to like steal insights and genius from an established podcast, the Scran podcast.
You know what? It's actually aligning very perfectly because the end of your series is aligning with the start of our ninth series.
Which
kicks off on the 25th of July. So there you go.
Yeah, we're currently on our summer break, which is fun because I didn't realise.
our summer break.
Yeah,
because I'm not on holiday.
Right. Okay. Because you pre-record lots of episodes and then.
Yeah, and I was like, Kelly, when's our summer break? And she's like, we're on it.
You're on it, babes.
It's like it's over. Sorry, I need some links. Thanks very much.
Isn't that adult life though? Just when you realise the holiday has started, it's already over. But instead of going in a timeline, maybe we'll just jump in to what's coming up for us this season on the Scran podcast.
Oh, Roz, do you want to go or shall I go? I don't mind.
No, you go.
So our first episode is very fittingly all about ice cream. So yeah, this is something we've been planning on doing for a while, but ice cream people are kind of hard to tie down in the summer, would you believe? Even in Scotland, and we recorded some episodes just after the last sort of little heat wave we had before the most recent one. So it was perfect. They were like totally exasperated and like flapping about the place. But no, it's great. We spoke to a couple of different producers and sort of more established one and a newer one. And yeah, it's great. It was great because the second last episode we did on our A series was about Italians in Scotland, and actually some of the ice cream stuff could have sat nicely on that episode as well. So there's a nice little sort of theme running from the end of series 8 into the start of series 9, kind of accidentally, you know, but we do reference it in the ice cream episode because we interviewed Yolanda Luca from Luca's Ice Cream. She's the third generation ice cream maker. They actually started in the Cowgate, which I wasn't aware of. I just associate them with Musselburgh. And they've still got a cafe in Morningside as well. But a lot of Yolanda's history was very similar to discussions we'd had with people on our sort of Italians in Scotland episode, which I think was probably one of my favourite episodes. Definitely series 8, but maybe ever. It was just really lovely, really kind of got to the heart of why it's so important to have food memories and how food is such a leveler, but also like how it marks all these different significant occasions in our lives and, you know, not necessarily hugely elaborate ones, but maybe really intimate ones. And it was just really fabulous. So if anybody hasn't listened to Scran, I would say check that episode out. That's pretty good jumping off point.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I mean, I suppose me and Lindsay, it is no surprise that we respond strongly to the human stories behind food. And heritage is a great place to find human stories. I'm wondering for yourself, is there lots of moments of that where you're jumping around the country, you're talking to producers, you're talking to historians, you're talking to bloggers and influencers. Are there moments where you found really great human stories that have kind of surprised you or jumped up on you?
Or I suppose another way you could ask that question is, do you start off with a topic in mind, or does the topic come to you based on the conversations you have?
So, yeah, I guess we're very much a team in that sense, Roz and I, because Roz is like the total food and drink expert. You know, I mean, I had very little experience in dealing with food and drink until I started working on Scran 4 years ago. So what'll often happen is poor Roz will be like, what about this? And I'll be like, yes, why don't we blah blah blah. And then other times Roz will be like, what about this? And I'll be like, oh my god, no. You know, so we have and that, to be fair, that happens much less than the former. So the idea can come sort of from anywhere, really. But I guess a lot of it comes from Roz's sort of expertise for a story and her nose for a story when it comes to food. So like that, I guess we'll a bit like, I mean, I know you guys are focused on sort of history, but like similar to you guys, we want to celebrate everything about food, you know. So it's telling those stories, but it's also saying, you know, how is Scotland innovating, you know, who are the people behind all these things that are happening? And I think we often have those situations where we'll go into a conversation with somebody and you're not really expecting the things you end up talking about. Roz, I'm thinking about, do you remember the one we did at Cardhu? Do you remember that? The ambassadors for Cardhu, we were interviewing them. And the designer, her name escapes me.
Siobhan McKenzie.
She talked about having a teacher in school who told her she'd go nowhere. And it was really horrendously, like, she'd been, you know, she'd really put up with a lot. And she was just trying, she was talking about, she was an ambassador for them, and she wasn't, you know, she was just talking about how supporting other women in the industry and that kind of thing was very important, because obviously Cara do have this female front, you know, their whole thing is the women that, you know, distilled the whiskey, and how they, you know, avoided all the different legalities that were in place at the time. So she told a great story where, like, people were nearly in tears listening to, you know, these little things that, like, you just go off on a little tangent, and it's really powerful. I mean, they were great. You, Giovanni Eusebi, her stories were fabulous, because she was talking about, you know, taking over the deli in Glasgow from her father, was it, that ran it, Roz? And then...
it was our mum and dad in Shettleston, and then... but, like, the memories of our gran in Italy and how evocative food is for that. And then it was the same with Sabrina. Like, her mum had not long passed away, and you could tell that she was still quite, not, like, visibly upset, but, like, you know, the memory of, like, her mum used to cook for them, and she would always put flowers out on the table, because that was, like, bringing, they were, like, what did she say? They were, like, the summer. Like, she wanted to make their time with her, like, the summer. And, yeah, it was nice.
That's Sabrina Damiani from... Damiani Fine Dining in Edinburgh. She did the most amazing afternoon tea spread for us. Roz and I nearly fell over when we walked in the door. It was out of this world. And we've tasted and experienced some lovely meals as part of the podcast, but this was next level. It was just supreme. If I was doing a catering event and I had a really nice budget, I would be all over this. Like, she is amazing, amazing.
I suppose I'm interested to find out, on both those parts, has being part of a food podcast, being part of food media and eating lots of great food and talking to lots of great food people, has that changed your relationship to food or to dining? And then on the other side, where you're hearing lots of these, like, really great family stories, emotional stories, human stories, has that changed your any other part of your life in hearing from so many different people? That's a giant question. Please take your time.
I'll let you go first, Roz.
So doing my job, has it changed my relationship with food and dining? It's probably, in a really sad way, because it is work, made it more central to my life. I know we all have to eat and drink, but a lot of my time out of work, like, after sorting out my kitchen tonight, I went up to an event up in Bear's Den. So a lot of my social time out of work is going to food and drink events for work, but it doesn't really feel like work because it's, you know, it's drinks or it's canapés or it's a nice meal. So it sort of made what I would have done anyway with friends or family more central to my life, but it's all kind of work. That's probably quite sad. But because it's food and drink, it doesn't feel like I'm working all the time, if you know what I mean.
I've got to say, it doesn't feel sad, Rosalind. I know.
Tiny violin.
I know that in practice, that must be a very complicated thing to balance in your head. But from over here, I can't say, if you need to relieve yourself of this burden... back onto the wild, that would be
you there can start being my plus one.
There's Peter auditioning for, like, you know, your cover, Roz, when you're
the Scotsman. Yeah. No.
Do you find, though, when you're sort of, if you ever have moments when you're sort of eating alone or you prepare food for yourself and it's sort of beyond, you know, it's not part of that professional trajectory where you're meeting people and doing all that side of things, do you think is like public and private food different for you, or are they all one and the same in the way that you think about them?
It's probably quite different. It's like cooking at home, I'm like very much batch cooking, trying not to think too much about it, like trying to eat healthily, but I'm not putting any amount of, like, I'm not putting care into it, but like I'm working late, so I need something to be fast and easy. Made it on a Sunday to last through to like Tuesday. It's very different, like, you know, on plates, on knees in front of the telly type thing, if we're in. With friends and stuff, it is different. Like, going out for my birthday or, like, doing something, because you could quite easily have it all spill into one. Like, you know, you could arrange something for more private events that's something to do with work, whether it's do you know someone or you've been invited somewhere or whatever, but you kind of have to stop blurring the lines at some point between what's working, what's not, because these things are great, but you've got to then turn it into something for work, if you know what I mean, whether it's an article or a podcast or something on social media, and it all just becomes very all-consuming. As nice as it is, you know, you do have to try and separate these things because it is food and drink. I think if I was, you know, writing about politics, I wouldn't be going out on, you know, like a Thursday night to do more on politics. Mm. Yeah.
And Kelly, because you produce a few different podcasts, don't you?
Yes. So
you're not entirely focused on food. Do you still have that relationship with eating out and dining and being to things, being complicated? Or
It's funny because I don't. I think just partly because of life stage, partly because of where I live, I don't have a great, like, I don't go out for dinner very often. You know what I mean? So I tend to cook fairly, like, a bit like Roz, practical. I've got young kids, you know, it's more about, like, stuff they want to eat plus getting vegetables into them rather than, you know, really actually putting care and attention into what. Maybe on a Sunday it gets a bit more time, but that's about it. So I love it because I get to go to all these restaurants and taste all this food that I would probably get very rare opportunity to do otherwise. So that's fabulous. And obviously the podcast has taken us to places I would not have been in Scotland, guaranteed, except for the podcast. You know, I'm thinking about like Highlands and Islands kind of thing, you know, and meeting some fantastic people. And I suppose, yeah, like it's funny because, you know, whiskey obviously is a huge theme in Scran, and I don't drink whiskey. I've never liked whiskey. Fine. Although I've always been like, I'll try Raz, I'll always try, you know. So we'll have, you know, a dram wherever we go and I'll be like, yeah, it's okay, it's fine. And, you know, again, it's like you meet people and they say, oh my God, you'd work on that podcast. And what about the whiskey? And, you know, I've been gifted lots of bottles of whiskey through the podcast as well. And I'm like, just adding them to my collection over here that my husband is slowly drinking, or I'm trying to prevent him from drinking. Yeah. So in that respect, you know, it's broadened my horizons in certain respects, definitely. But what I love about it as well is, like, I'm a documentary maker when in my spare time, and just meeting the people and hearing the stories, I just love all of that. I love the humans behind the behind the food. And, like, you know, you guys will know this better than anybody, but when you're sitting talking to somebody on Shetland about, you know, what their grandmother, you know, the fish she used to catch and how she treated it, and, you know, it's just so evocative and just sort of like inspiring in terms of like how we should treat our food and how we think about food. And so it has definitely changed my mind, not changed my mind, but as I say, sort of broadened my view on the whole thing.
I think that's really interesting. One of the things that we are constantly talking about when we look at these histories of food, particularly in the last series, we've been looking at people predominantly Victorian, but not exclusively.
And 99% mainly, women.
Well, mainly women as well. And you have this really interesting tension throughout all these texts that women are either writing or engaging with, where it's like, food is public but also private because the food you make kind of opens you up to judgment from other people. And, like, I mean, we've not really looked too much at restaurant culture. We've mostly been looking at, you know, food producers or families or recipe writers. But I think it's really interesting now because food has almost become this conduit for stories that weren't told previously because they weren't thought of as important enough, or, you know, as they were too private or whatever. So now that you're able to kind of use that as a vehicle to open up to these stories as you speak to different people is really, really important.
I think it's really interesting because the few references we've made to the podcast so far have all been conversations with women. And probably the reason is because women talk about the emotion associated with the food. And that's more engaging and touching for me than, say, like, what this new piece of kit that is, you know, revolutionizing sustainability in whiskey making, which is also very interesting to other people. But I guess, as I say, as a kind of, like, you know, someone that's interested in, like, social norms and sort of, like, social history and that kind of thing, I think it's fascinating, and it is, and I was thinking about it today, it's often women, but it's because I suppose women are more willing to share in general their feelings about things, you know, and how it makes them feel, than a lot of the men we've interviewed about similar stuff, you know.
It is interesting how much that gender dimension's perhaps still at play. I mean, a lot of the episodes we've done about these like big families, so whether it's Baxters or Tunnocks, it tends to be, maybe less so Tunnocks, but it tends to be the men that kind of begin the business and they do that kind of side of things. But actually, the sort of humanizing selling point comes from the women. Mm-hmm. And often a lot of the innovation comes from the women too. Obviously, historically, you have that difficulty where it was harder for women to begin things, they needed that support sometimes, but they become the representation that's tied to food because it is a way of understanding people in a way that I don't know whether men connect to as much. Perhaps Peter, I feel like, as the one man in this conversation,
don't bring me into this. No, I don't know. What do I think? And being very careful about my words.
Right, I suppose, you know, speaking of like, you know, because women traditionally cooked the food in the house, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Then I suppose there is that sort of ownership, you know what I mean? Like of that process and that, you know, kind of real estate in the history of food is sort of women, you know, own that, don't they? Mm. Less so nowadays, but in the past, for sure.
I think, get ready everyone, and I think it is generational, and I think still our generation will experience it. I think women have more emotional touchstones to food, and so you can get very quickly into an honest and open conversation with a woman about food, because if you talk about your gran teaching you to bake, your mum teaching you to bake, the way that food worked in your family, you were perhaps more aware of. There was maybe expectations of you to be involved or to be helping. The conversations around food.
Mm.
I think men have fewer touchstones, but if you can get there, ask them about, like, was your dad the one that cooked breakfast on the weekends? Mm. Or what was your mum's favorite birthday cake recipe she used to make? There are ways to get into it, but you have to be very pointed, I think, with men to really try and find that place where they can connect that emotionally.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about the emotional touchstones. I think the other thing though to remember is, like, in terms of cultural capital, historically men have had all these different routes through which to esteem themselves, establish themselves, express themselves. As you know, when women couldn't actually access anything but being in the home, food was potentially one of the only ways you could express yourself. So, and that's not to romanticize it, because a lot of time it was a hard graft and people were just cooking to survive and cooking to, like, feed their families and do all that sort of thing. But potentially, as, like, one of the things that you were expected to do, it became an arena in which you could tell stories, you could express yourself. So I think it's probably, a dual tale of, like, that emotional side of things working really well through food as something that we literally put in our bodies to sustain ourselves, to feed people we love, you know, that side of things. But also being one of the only routes through which historically women had some, like, sway, I suppose.
Yeah, and value, yeah.
I mean, in thinking about that conversation about emotional touchstones, was there anything that came to mind for you about the, like, do you have really good food memories or things that you hold close to you or things which are poignant for you today that make you, sometimes if I'm buttering toast and the bread's particularly flimsy, I think about my gran because she used to keep it in the fridge. And, like, that bread was indestructible, would never give up for a butter. And there's, like, wee bits of, bits of mindful food that drop in throughout the day. Do you guys have anything that connects you to food?
Like, little things like that, I suppose. Like, my dad, growing up, he was working loads. And it's funny you talk about, like, women and doing all the cooking, because it's probably our generation that it's not that those traditional roles, like, you know, Gordon, my boyfriend, cooks as much as I do, if not a bit more, whereas my dad wasn't there, he was out working. He cooks a bit more now, but what he would make us on a weekend is magic toast, a similar thing. Like, it was really, really lightly toasted white bread, like full of butter, and it was magic. I don't know why it was magic.
Why was it magic?
Just toast and butter.
Sorry?
Was it just toast and butter?
Yeah, really lightly white bread, toasted white bread with butter, but it was like amazing. I don't know what was amazing. I mean, I really don't eat white bread anymore, so if I had it now, I'd find it amazing because it's white bread. But that, because he didn't really do that, that was quite a nice thing. But like my mum, like, she's pescatarian, so they'd have a lot of dinner parties when we were young, and the smell of like a lasagna cooking, or like, you know, like some, the smell of parmesan in the oven, which sounds like it would smell horrible, but actually to me smells really comforting, because it's like her making a big meal for people. That's really nice. But just loads of stuff, like the clotted dumpling recipe from my gran, or my cousin's gran, who was like everyone's nanny. They were the best clotted dumplings ever, but we don't have the recipe because they're no longer with us, and they didn't write them down, and we didn't ask, because you think, well, you know, someone will have written it down, we'll know at some point. So things like that, like I'll never be able to make that. So that's a bit like, oh, you know, that's quite sad. But yeah, it's just those things, isn't it? It's like your history, your food history, and your family history are all sort of intertwined.
I have so many of those bits and pieces where I'm like, I wish I had asked. But then I also think it kind of, without experiencing not being able to ask, you don't know the urgency of which to start asking questions now. You have to have a little bit of heartbreak to avoid a much bigger heartbreak later on, you know?
Yeah.
But Kelly, what do you have?
I suppose just on what you were saying there, the thing is, it's like rewatching a film you loved as a child. Like, it's never as good as when you were the child. So maybe you don't need to ask those questions. Maybe you just protect that memory. You know, now you guys do because it's your profession and you really do want to know.
Yeah.
But for other people, you know, maybe
let's leave sleeping dogs lie, Lindsay. Let's no more research. We're done with it.
Forget the past.
But yeah, so my grandmother was a prolific baker. And she was, you know, she raised two kids when her husband died very young. So she, you know, was like, hadn't a lot of money and just had to do everything she could to get by. And so she did a lot of home baking. So her like brown soda bread was the best, and apple tarts, my God, just, and rhubarb at the right time of the year. And yeah, just like all those kind of staples, you know. It's funny, I'm trying to think what I associate with the foodie things I associate with my mom. Like both my grandmother and my mother are like the best pancake makers, like drop scones really is what they are, as opposed to, you know, crepes or anything like that. They're like, and that is just, that was like a weekly meal in our house, pancakes for dinner, you know. And yeah, like more kind of traditional Irish stuff, like Irish stew my mom would make, bacon and cabbage, although my other grandmother was like the queen of bacon and cabbage. She would put the bacon on at about 8 o'clock in the morning for it to be ready by like 5. And she always had a cigarette in her mouth, you know, with the ash kind of burning down. And we were like, oh my God, how much ash is in the pot?
It's not bacon, it's fine.
But it tasted great. So, you know.
Do you ever make cabbage and bacon now, and do you have a craving for a cigarette? Is it a Pavlovian response to the smell of cabbage and salty, sparkling bacon?
I do make it. I'm afraid I've turned into a plastic patty. I usually make it for St. Patrick's Day, but thankfully no cigarette cravings after.
I'm actually really interested in, coming from Ireland to Scotland, being involved in food, I feel like Ireland is so good at like protecting its national recipes and its dishes. It's not a joke to them. Tato crisps are not a joke. They're a vibrant part of culture.
Yeah.
I think in Scotland we're far meaner to ourselves about our food and our food heroes and our pantry products and things. We don't have a level of respect for it. Have you seen that coming over here to Scotland? And do you have any words of advice for the entire of Scottish culture?
I think it's a difficult one, because I think Ireland, Britain, you know, we maybe don't have the same food culture. We definitely don't have the same food culture as some other countries. You know, we don't have that massively rich heritage. So I think it is important to celebrate and protect what you do have. I think Ireland does seafood very well, Irish beef, you know, there's like core products that are, you know, synonymous with Ireland, Guinness, you know, and Ireland is very proud of them. Tato, I would put in the same league as Iron Brew, probably, Peter, to be honest with you. But yeah, I think you're being a bit harsh there, maybe. You know, I think Scotland does a great job of promoting itself. And certainly, I would always compare and contrast. You know what I mean? I'm always like, you know, is whiskey here better than whiskey there? I'm the worst person for that, obviously. But, you know, seafood, I would be very, like, critical of. And I find both nations cherish it, you know. So, and treat it quite... you know, with a lot of respect. So I think that's good. I think that the thing we don't have that you guys definitely have is that sort of, there's this kind of culture around sort of deep fried this and deep fried that. But we equally have some terrible food elements as well. Like, I think if you were to pick a national dish in Ireland at the moment, it would probably be the spice bag or like spice the deli bag, roll. Yeah. You know, these are... Ireland has this like insane deli culture that just you don't find here. It's kind of similar. You get it in America, but you know, where you can literally go to a deli and have whatever you want, you know. But a lot of these delis are in service stations, which is in itself a kind of a unique thing. So I had to kind of learn to wean myself off the fact that you could stop and get whatever you wanted to eat at a petrol station when I moved to Scotland. But it's much celebrated, but I mean, it is convenience food, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, I mean, good at promoting the big things, but I think we're very similar in many ways, to be honest.
Because I was, we held a World Bannock Day with that fantastic sparkling help from Rosalind Erskine herself as part of the campaign. And I find myself having to defend why we were trying to celebrate Bannocks. And I kept going to a part of like, I feel like Ireland's very proud of soda bread.
Yes, absolutely.
They don't even try to defend it because it's revered. It's accessible. It's part of culture. There's a relationship to that, which is so aspirational, I think, for Scotland in many ways.
Yeah.
I can't think of like cheap, accessible products that the masses have eaten that we hold up to say, no, this is part of our culture. We're going to serve it in every cafe if you want it.
Yeah, I guess like porridge is probably a good example, isn't it? Like of that kind of type of food. But yeah, maybe less celebration going on around or whatever. Although there is that like golden spurtle and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah. I mean, we had people making bannocks. It was great. Like, and again, as Peter said, Rosalind, you were so helpful. Like raising the awareness of what a bannock. I think the problem might be like people don't know what a bannock is.
Okay,
we're starting from scratch. Instance. Yeah,
yeah, and in fairness, this year Peter and I were delivering this like 2 weeks before our symposium.
I don't. It wasn't even 2 weeks. It was about four days, hon.
Well, do you know what? You guys did an amazing job, and also the symposium was excellent because we were there and we covered it, and you did really great. So don't beat yourselves up too much. I guess maybe you're right. Like, you know, people rave about certain things, don't they, in different places. Like, I often meet people who are completely, like, they hear the word buttery and they just go to pieces, you know. So I guess it just depends on what your own sort of food lore is, you know, and where you're from. I mean, I remember learning about burnt rolls when I first moved over here, and I was like, sorry? Burnt.
I think you'll find that's a well-fired role.
There you go. How disrespectful of me.
No, I know. You come into my home on my wedding day. No.
So, yeah, I guess you just, you know, I would try to be respectful of other people's. And actually, I've tasted it. It's amazing. And you know what it is. And, you know, but I guess it's that heritage thing, isn't it? And everyone's a little bit more protective of their own memories and their own past.
And I feel like beyond the actual food that it is, whether it's a well-fired roll or porridge or soda bread or a bannock or a buttery, and buttery for me, that's the Aberdeenshire stalwart, but it's not the food itself, it's what that means, it's how, it's where you eat it, who you eat it with, like those memories, and that's why people get so up in arms about things. So mm-hmm. I think, yeah, you need, it's, I think one of the things that Peter and I are really interested in, as you are with that like human element, it's how those stories come to make things so important.
Mm.
And I think if we can understand that better as historians or as people who are in the food and drink sector who are covering those stories, it will make it easier to protect things going forward. Because I think so much now is at risk of, like, you know, I mean, I'm guilty of it too. I've got a whole bookcase of cookbooks in my kitchen, but I Google recipes. And I think in this day and age with the technology that we're currently, you know, dealing with, you're almost at risk of losing yes. all that history.
Yes.
So that's a part of it I'm particularly interested in.
Going back to sort of like not so much food of your ancestors, but like Scottish foods and memories and it being very personal. I don't know if you guys have read Pam Brunton's book, Between Two Waters. I'm reading it just now.
So good. I'm like working my way through it. Like, I kind of got it. I've not been to Inver. It's like dream location. I really want to go. And I got it thinking, oh, this is going to be a lovely read. And I've been sort of working my way slowly chapter through chapter because it's really difficult as a read, but as it should be. Like, she's amazing at kind of blowing up or like showing all the roots of our food in ways that are sometimes quite uncomfortable. It's an amazing mm-hmm. book. Is there anything in particular, Rosalind, that you that like strikes you? Obviously, you're working in Scottish food, like you're very involved in the sector. Is there anything in Pam's book that sort of surprises you, or like how are you finding the read?
So I started it at the weekend because I was just sitting outside basically all weekend because it was so nice, and it's more just she's articulating in a way that I'd love to be able to do myself in terms of like, what is Scottish food? What is modern Scottish food? Why, you know, why is it being, you know, the deep fried mart? Like, you know, she doesn't really go into that, but it's like, she talks about how when she first opened Inver, it'd been Inver Cottage before, so it'd been this established restaurant, and it served like pub grub, basically. And somebody phoned, they were quite quiet, and someone phoned her up and asked what they had in the menu, and she described all these amazing sounding dishes, and they seemed annoyed that there wasn't, you know, proper Scottish food in terms of like lasagna or fish and chips or, and it's like this very just it's not really surprised me, it's just very interested me because it's a question I feel like we're asking ourselves a lot, like who are we, why do we eat what we eat? Well, because I'm very much in it, and I'm like, Kelly, like you're saying, the seafood's really good and the beef's really good, and but we don't really, like, you know, we don't get to eat our seafood. I'm not like mm-hmm. your everyday person on the street in terms of like I'm going about and doing my shopping and I'm buying Tesco's own chorizo and like a load of veg that's probably, I mean, I get a veg box, but so, you know, sometimes you're like, oh, this is convenient, I'll get this. And you look and, you know, it's prawns and they're from Vietnam. And so like this, what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis and what I think we should be celebrating, which is what I try to do through various different parts of work, is not everyone's day-to-day, including my own. So her talking about, you know, why is it that we have the food culture we have when we've got all this amazing stuff that we don't necessarily have access to? You know, why are we eating? You know, why is the life expectancy terrible in certain parts of Glasgow? Yeah. Like, why is, you know, the poverty really bad? Like, it's just sort of, it's just been intriguing more than surprising. And she's done it in a way, like, I don't think I'm the same as you. I was expecting it to be something else completely. It's very educational, and mm-hmm. I'm just really enjoying it because I don't often read books like that that really properly, it's like being back at uni, like it really was really going into like theory and like, you know, what people have said and studies, and I'm normally just reading like a fiction book, you know, for 2 minutes every night and then that's it. So no, I think it's she's answering or at least trying to explain a fundamental part of probably what we're all involved in for work.
Yeah, there's such a thing there that you've really nicely illustrated, Rosalind, about like the gap between the ideal and like what Scotland can provide and how we can eat from Scotland and like the reality of the time we have to cook, the availability, the cost of ingredients. I mean, like knowing what to do with those ingredients, it's really tricky to like try and you can't push food agendas on people because the reality is for most of us, food is a small footnote to our lives that's kind of squeezed in the time that even if you're working in food and it's your great passion, more often than not, you're kind of grabbing bits and bobs where you can. And I think one of the things that, and I don't want to speak for you, Peter, but one of the things that I think it really drives the work that we do is trying to instill or reinstill a sense of like importance and value around that food and like the time spent. And it's a huge change that is well beyond our power to make, because it would need changes in working cycles and, you know, cost of ingredients and cost of energy. But if we, you know, when you look at the amount of money that people used to spend on food versus their wage to now, we used to spend so much more on food, but you would actually have the time to do things with it. And obviously, you know, the emancipation of women and is amazing. What it does mean is that people aren't in the kitchens as much. We've just kind of carved that time away from our life, which is fine. But when it then creates these breaking points where you only have time to value food if you can afford it, like, that's an issue.
Yeah, universal basic income would be a great thing.
Yep. I was literally talking about that at my work today. Like, we need 4-day weeks, universal basic income. Like,
yeah, I think with Scran, like, we definitely see the themes of sustainability, seasonality, provenance, like all of that is huge always. And I suppose sometimes we can be guilty of, we go and we speak to chefs working in really good restaurants or very established, or, you know, private dining chefs, or, you know, people who have access to the best ingredients, the best local ingredients, because they can afford to. And of course, the difficulty there is that those ingredients aren't available to a lot of people. And like you say, Lindsay, the cost, the time, the convenience, you know, we've dug ourselves a hole and we're all just sitting in it at the moment. But there definitely is a conversation to be had around how that all impacts on climate change and all of that as well. You know, that's, and the environmental impact of what we're doing. And I do think we will get back there again, but I think it's going to take a really long time to re-educate people. And, you know, we've talked about this a million times, Roz, as well, like, you know, going back to basics and like just educating people at school about cooking and using seasonal products and where to get those products at a reasonable price and what time of year and what are the types of fish you can be eating that aren't going to cost you a fortune. And, you know, just these really simple things that most people aren't aware of or aren't being taught it by anyone.
And I think not only are they not being taught it by anyone, there's that gap there, certainly generationally. It's, and even in education, like, home economics is now, you know, if a school can do it, they will, but it's not a part of the curriculum anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it does exist in some schools, but quite often it's one of the courses that gets cut. So we have that gap in terms of like the actual education side of things. But I also think there's an uncomfortable reality where the way that most of us shop and the way that most of us buy food is actually discouraging that knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, you buy things, you buy vegetables, you buy your meat in its plastic wrapping. Like, the way that our consumption works now has like purposely probably distanced us from the reality of our food.
Mm-hmm.
And that results in like de-skilling, and yeah, it's worrying.
On that note, let's take a break.
That actually does, I wanted to ask this earlier. Do you have like a favorite place in Scotland you visited with the podcast, or like,
yeah,
does anything stand out?
I think Raz and I would both agree. Like, funnily enough, speaking about, you know, going back to when I first started on the podcast, because Gran was up and running for about a year before I came on board. And I'm pretty sure from the get-go, Roz was banging on about going to Shetland and to going to Up Hella Yeah. And I was like, Vikings? What? Okay, whatever. Yeah. And, you know, the fact that it was really difficult to get to and it's always booked up and travel is chaotic, et cetera, et cetera. And it took me a few years, but I got us there eventually.
You made it happen.
And it was fantastic. And honestly, the whole getting there, recording, the day of the thing, everything couldn't have gone better until the morning we were supposed to go home, which was about 3 hours after we went to bed.
Oh,
and yeah, there was like a blizzard, basically. And that was us. Oh, we ended up staying for an extra couple of days.
it was really windy. And we knew the flight we cancelled. And I was driving this tin car, rental car, around these roads at like 7 in the morning. I think you thought I was going to drive off the edge of the cliff.
It was.
There's no way we needed to be going to the airport. But we went because they didn't tell us that it was cancelled, even though it was going to be cancelled. So yeah, it was good fun. It was almost like Christmas again, like the anticipate getting there. Yeah. And like it was really nice cold sunny day and like everyone's really excited and the anticipation of this thing that's happening, and then it goes on right the way through the night. And yeah, it was great.
Yeah, lovely mix of like tradition and celebration and, you know, pageantry and event. And yeah, it was great. And like obviously we were able to, there's a food, like a little food festival that happens at the same time, so we were able to talk to a lot of people about what was happening on the island in terms of like modern production, like a new whiskey distillery and stuff. But also, like I mentioned earlier, we were talking to one woman who was telling us about how, you know, they used to dry fish and salt fish and really cool like food history. There was another girl who's like a huge influencer on TikTok that makes basically kind of candies and fudge.
Oh, like marshmallows. I've seen
her. Yeah, she's amazing. The Island Larder, I think it is. Isn't that Ross? And her accent was just to die for. And, you know, I just, that kind of stuff I just love, you know. But yeah, so that was fab. A lot of our island visits have been really fantastic because it's just that bit different, you know, and it's out of the norm of what you're used to. But other, I mean, I love our Christmas episodes. Like, I love them. I just love them because we put an awful lot of effort into them. And it's the same sort of, I think, Peter, you were on one of our last ones and it was great to have you join us to talk about, you know, ye olde Christmases in Scotland. But I just love...
Gather children, the history of Christmas.
And the ivy.
And it's just the combination of, we try to have like, you know, there's obviously kind of a food focus, so we'll get a chef on to talk about some food element. We might get someone to talk about, you know, how to dress a table, or, you know, what you should be doing for Hogmanay, or like some other sort of celebratory element. But then we also talk to, every year we talk to a charity and about what they're doing and how that impacts the people who are maybe not eating with their family that year for whatever reason. We met some really lovely young people this year who were homeless. One guy who wants to be a chef, like they were just, you know, so grateful to have people looking after them and making them food on Christmas Day. And, you know, you have, it's just all that stuff, and putting together those stories kind of gets to the heart of what, you know, A, the podcast is about, and B, Christmas, you know. So I love doing them. They're a huge amount of work, but yeah. And obviously like chasing around turkeys, trying to get turkey noises and that kind of stuff is great crack too.
Done that. And what was it, not some random time of the year, so it was like August or September?
It was September, yeah. Well, they were quite small turkeys, weren't they, the ones that we were chasing at that point.
You need to start the Christmas content so early. I think by the time Christmas and Hogmanay rolled around the last year, Peter and I had been speaking about it for like 3 months.
Yeah.
I've just started my Christmas pitches.
There you go. Oh. Like, God, don't give me anxiety. I'm like, no, not till after August. We do a big Foodies Day at the Festival episode in August, which takes an awful lot of production planning. So until that's done, I cannot think about Christmas. But no, you're right. It does. It takes ages. But actually, we've got better over the years for recording things as we go. So if we happen to be on, I don't know, like a farm in Ayrshire that happens to grow Brussels sprouts, we'll do the Brussels sprout chat. But we might do it in June and we have it then in the can. But it might only be 2 minutes long. That's why those episodes have so much in them, because we do plan them out as far in advance as we can. And we're always like, oh, and what about Christmas to people, you know? And if they've got an interesting take or they do something different for Christmas, we'll try and, if we don't talk to them about it right then, we'll try and tee them up as well for later in the year. So it's good, definitely, for production planning to have do that kind of thing.
These are excellent tips.
And that brings us right on to a question I had, which was, do you have any advice? We have dragged ourselves through our second season of this bloody podcast and are fighting for our lives, trying to find time to record and sit down and edit and push it all out. It's a machine in itself. Do you have any advice on when did it turn a corner for you? When did you find a rhythm? Are there any practical things that we can do to keep the Scottish Food History podcast alive?
Raz, do you want to go?
Well, it's sort of different in the sense that this is part of my job, but the consistency is key. Like, I have a lot of respect for people who do this in their free time because I love it and I would love to have it as my own, but I would be the same. I would struggle. It's the time and you've got to be consistent. So we do this in our work time because it's part of work. So, you know, we'll do recordings online in the morning. We'll maybe take a full day out of the office to go and do them. So the onus is there to have one every 2 weeks because it's part of our jobs. But then that's a challenge to fit into, you know, I've got deadlines and I've got, you know, other things going on. For me, it's enjoyment. Like, you know, it's the one thing that I would not want to give up as part of my job. Yeah. You know, if they came along and they said, you're doing too much, which, you know, I am, I would be like, well, I have to keep the podcast. But, you know, it just, the rhythm is that it's through work. It's through, you know, Kelly's way more organised than me. So you're kind of organising things in the background and answering emails, whereas I'm trying to wade through 3,500 unread emails and do other things. So working together and having one person be very organised and very on it and another person in the background going, what about this? That's happening to people's time that's really hard to do.
I feel like you might be close to the partnership that we have developed here in the Scottish Food History Podcast.
Isn't it funny though, because I guess that's how it works, you know, in a way, like host and producer, like that's, someone's got to be the producer and sort of be like, no, we're going to do this, or we need to do this on this day, or what is the, you know, and keep putting the parameters on things. And that's the producer's job or the editor's job, you know. I guess you guys just need to kind of figure those roles out yourselves. But
yeah,
you're doing it weekly, aren't you? So that's a lot.
I mean, at the moment.
We're doing it weekly.
But then you miss weeks.
And we yeah,
is it?
We do it weekly until we don't, and then we'll have seven weeks off, and then come back.
That actually just sounds like my podcast I used to do with my sister, Fox Force 5. We would be like hell for leather, and then something would go wrong. We'd be like, well, we took an unexpected 4 week break there.
Yeah,
yeah, it's very hard, and it's very hard when you've got other priorities, you know, like, whether it's your job, your day job, or life responsibilities or whatever, and like the podcast goes to the end of the list. And the horrible thing about it is, as Roz says, it's probably the thing you enjoy the most, or one of the things you enjoy the most, talking about something you love, you know, and then it gets neglected, and actually it makes you a bit sad, doesn't it, when it does. So I guess, yeah, I work a lot with different teams around the country because I work for National World, who owns the Scotsman. What I always say to people who come to me to talk about podcasts or they want to make a podcast is, I'm like, A, do you realize how much resource this is going to be? B, does your editor realize how much resource this is going to be? And the fact that, you know, you won't be writing articles when you're recording podcasts, you know, you need the time to do it. And C, don't overextend yourself too quickly. So, you know, commit to a single series of 6 episodes or 8 episodes. If you feel like the time pressure is going to be a lot, make it fortnightly or monthly and go from there. And you guys have hit the ground running. Like, you've got great passion for your topic. Like, you guys work really well together. The podcast is a lovely, interesting listen. So you're smashing it. So don't be too hard on yourselves.
We only invited you on here to get compliments.
I'm very happy to do that. Why do we keep inviting you guys over to us? We think you're great. So there you go.
Wonderful. Well, we like to finish off our podcasts with the same questions that we ask everyone. Mm-hmm. And I can think of no more qualified people than to answer the next question. So, morning roll order, what is your type of roll and what is your filling?
Not the well-fired one, although I do they are nice, but just
you mean
yeah,
a burnt one.
Yeah, not the burnt one. And it would probably be bacon and fried egg, lots of butter, lots of ketchup.
Mm. Oh my God, mine is the exact same, Roz. The fried egg, maybe not always, depending on what mood I'm in. If it's going to be really messy and I'm like on the go, no. But if I'm sitting down and I just need a good bit of scran, that's what I'd be going for.
Love the wee plug there. Okay, bread. Do you prefer plain bread or pan bread?
So I'm going to say pan. It's actually sourdough, but if I have to, I feel like pan bread is going to die, and it's quite sad. So I'm going to say pan.
Yeah, for those reasons, I should back you up, but I would be lying because I am more of a the opposite, unfortunately. But I'm not a big bread person, so I'm like not qualified to be honest with you.
Fair enough.
Well, if not bread for breakfast, is it porridge? How do you have your porridge?
Me, milky, lots of fruit, lots of berries, and lots of honey.
Made with milk with salt. But the best porridge ever, placed on Isla, called Glenegadale House. Loads of cream, loads of brown sugar, and a shot of Laphroaig.
Oh my God.
I wouldn't have that every day, but if you go there, have that. It is the best porridge ever.
It actually sounds good. It actually sounds really good.
It's really good.
Really good.
We need to go there.
My breakfast tomorrow is going to be real good. No, I'm joking. I wish. Okay, in terms of tunics, do you prefer a log, a wafer, or a tea cake?
Log.
Oh, it's got to be the tea cake. Come on, Raz. I'll arm wrestle you.
It's coconut.
It's delicious. Family recipe. You're going to add a family recipe into a national cookery book. What would that family recipe be?
Oh, I'm going to say, even though I couldn't even tell you what the recipe is, but my mum does the most awesome smoked poached haddock. Unbelievable. That's what I would add.
Yeah.
Probably my mum's butternut squash stuffed pasta or mozzarella meatballs.
These both sound excellent.
Can you get like take away some of that the next time you're at home and like bring it along when we're going out to record?
One of my best friends at uni going with food when he'd run out of his student loan and he wouldn't eat anything, so she realised this and she'd send food. Like I would go and visit and she'd send food back for him.
Oh.
So yeah, she definitely would do that for you.
Talk about women picking up the emotional labour of feeding men.
Okay, what ingredient in your kitchen do you find yourself reaching for the most when you're cooking?
Terrible confession, chili flakes.
How is that? Why is that terrible?
Oh, we're like, everything is spicy in this house. Everything, yeah. And my kids hate spice, which is funny. So, yeah, we obviously.
Give them time.
Yeah,
give
well, time. Exactly.
Yeah.
Probably similar, sriracha or chili flakes, or I mean, it's not an ingredient, but loads and loads of that blackthorn sea salt.
Oh, that is so good.
I'm having a personal sriracha renaissance.
Oh.
in my own life.
Oh,
personal sriracha renaissance sounds like a really RC band.
Yeah, it does.
Personal sriracha renaissance.
Oh, is it a renaissance? Is it that you haven't had it for a long time, or that you found
it's
it amazing?
That I bought my first. I've had it places.
Yeah.
And I have had chili sauces, hot sauces and things, but I got my first sriracha sauce the other day. I was just in Morrison's and I saw it and I was like, yeah, sure.
Oh my God, it goes on everything in our house.
Everything. Morning rolls.
Yeah.
Rice.
Everything. I've
had it with three meals today.
Excellent.
It's addictive though, I feel a little bit. We've started a new tradition in my home family at Christmas on Boxing Day or St. Stephen's Day, as we know it in Ireland. Is a hot wing challenge. So I love that we're creating all these new world traditions with food, you know. But it has, we've probably maybe landed on something recently enough where a pregnant woman won it last year. So we're like, is that got to do with being pregnant? So, you know, there's going to be a challenge for next year. Does the pregnant woman who's not pregnant anymore still win, or is it going, the crown going to go to somebody else?
You know, in 400 years, some Irish food historian is going to be reporting on this very trend that was started, and the mysticism of the pregnant woman that can eat anything. There'll be a story that will
like the folklore tale of the spiced chicken wing inducing your pregnancy.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, there you go. No, yes, it's moved on from the spicy curry to the spicy chicken wing. Yeah, exactly.
So, do you have a favourite Scottish word?
Oh, it's got to. So I was going to say right now it would be dree because the weather, but no, I love bulk.
Bulk. I love this from the food person. Bulk.
I know.
Yeah. A word I keep hearing a lot recently that I hadn't heard a lot of before is shen, which I love.
That's quite East Coast, I think.
Huh?
So that's quite East Coast, is it not, Shan?
Yeah, I was going to say, that is Welsh Shan. Yeah.
My partner's a Geordie and he says Shan. Really? And I've never really heard it before.
Well, he's on the East as well, so maybe it's the entire of the East.
But we've had this discussion about the word scran as well, and how, you know, some people think obviously it's like totally wholly Scottish, but obviously there's a sort of a military, it's like a military reference as well, and therefore you do get a lot of, again, northern people know what it is, but not necessarily southerners, you know.
Yeah There's a line somewhere like below Manchester that's like invisible.
Correct But we all knew that anyway, didn't we? Yes.
Okay, finally, what was the first job you can remember being given in the kitchen?
When my mum used to bake, it would be to basically lick the bowl. That's not a job, but like,
It's a pleasure, it's a privilege.
Yeah.
Yeah, God.
It's still a task. Yeah,
it's still a task, and you felt
it's still a verb. Yep. it's an action word. I think you're fine.
I think she then probably got me to help with stuff, but it was with the pretense
that was the payment.
Mm.
Yeah. I remember you know, cutting the scones out with a little tin I don't know what you call that, a cutter of some sort. Yeah. But I do remember doing the washing up, standing on a chair and slicing my finger open with a knife. So, yeah, I probably didn't offer to help very much after that for a while.
Scarred, literally and mentally.
Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on to the Scottish Food History Podcast and for blessing us on our final episode of season two. You have both brightened our own lives, our own listening lives, and we look forward to the rest of season nine.
Yeah, season
hopefully
nine.
You run into some food mysteries, and we are given a call on the big red phone. There's a research and emergency.
Yeah, do you know what? Like, you're lucky you don't get called every week. That's the way things are. But I'm sure we will definitely have you guys on series nine, and we'll be looking forward to when you guys return as well, and all the wonderful minutiae that we need in our lives as well.
The deep dive, the laser focus. Hyper focus podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much,
and for sharing all your expertise. It is, you give us something to aspire to. So.
I've got a question for you. Morning roll order. What is your type of roll, and what is the filling?
The question to end all questions, especially with you, I feel like if I revealed I didn't like morning rolls, our relationship would be over. But
O-V-E-R.
But it's fine. I do. I would like a sort of Glasgow roll, somewhere between well fired and not quite as hard done. And I would like a tatty scone, a square sausage, and an egg, and some brown sauce.
Mm.
What about you? King of morning rolls.
I'm a crispy morning roll myself. And actually, to be honest, see if I'm getting, if like I'm ordering a morning roll or whatever, I'll get potato scone and bacon. I like a crunchy potato scone because it needs to have texture.
Yeah.
And I actually as well, I like a crispy bacon. Ketchup, Lurpak.
Yeah. How do you take your bread, Peter? Plain or pan?
I have been getting back into a plain loaf, because I feel like it's my responsibility as a Scottish foodie to support the brand. But yeah,
I'm trying to move back into plain because actually I do really enjoy it. And it's never top of my grocery list. It's never the thing that I search for, but I never regret it when I get it.
No, I'm much the same. I probably buy pan more, and if I make bread, it's pan. But for me, there's something about plain that is like inherently nostalgic. If I'm ever feeling a bit sad and I want to like feel like I've chatted to my mum or my granny, I'll get some plain and I'll make toast.
Yeah, like a plain loaf with a Baxter's tomato soup is
Yes.
on a rainy autumn day.
Bellissimo, beautiful.
And Lindsay, how do you have your porridge?
Probably most of the time I would have it like sweet. I make it with water and then add a bit of milk. And I would have it with, I do salt it, and then I would add blueberries, cinnamon, and either some peanut butter or maple syrup. Although recently I've got very into like savory porridge, and I'll have it with like miso and some chili crisp and an egg.
Okay. Wow, that sounds amazing. I'm like a rolled oats, water, and then salt, and then I'll finish with like some brown sugar or maple syrup.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, it's perfect in its simplicity. What is your favorite tonics? I mean, I feel like we've probably covered this in previous episodes, but for the sake of the questions,
I think a tea cake. I do. I think I have a relationship with a caramel log.
You and a log have history.
We have history. It's a situationship I have with a tonics log, but I have to say a tea cake does reign supreme for me.
I'm a tea cake girl as well. They are just the best.
And if you're going to add a family recipe into a national cookery book, Lindsay, what would that recipe be? I haven't given any thought, so please take time with your question.
Well, mine would have to be my granny's pasta mince.
Oh, of course,
is a sort of pasta bake. And that's obviously not what everyone would call it, but that's what we called it. My granny used to make it. And it's pasta bake with beef mince, onions, mushrooms. And then the sauce is made from one tin of Campbell's condensed mushroom soup and one tin of Campbell's condensed tomato soup. And that's the sauce. And then you like mix it all together, cheese on top. It's like, on paper, pretty horrible sounding, but in reality is like the nicest comfort food I've ever had.
I think you need to make it for me.
For
the beginning of season 3, we should start with Granny's pasta mince.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, I will. Absolutely.
I was doing a collab with someone that I can't talk about because it'll be out tomorrow. So if you're listening on Monday, visit my page on Tuesday to see who I'm doing a collab with. But they started chatting about, I was asking them these questions, and he started chatting about his mum's minced macaroni. And I was like, stop, I need to record this. And I was like, is there a tin of condensed soup in your mum's? He's like, no. I was like, okay, turn it off. It's fine.
What? Yeah. What about you, Peter? What would your family recipe be?
The two things that I'm thinking of are both cheese related, which is no surprise. The first one is my dad's scrambled egg and cheese.
Oh, yeah.
Which we just, half the family believe it's called scrambled eggy cheese, which is just to do with her terrible Paisley accents because the N got lost in amongst there. But scrambled egg and cheese, which is like a very like, it's like a tight curd scrambled egg with an extra mature cheddar block added. Or alternatively, my granny's cauliflower cheese, which is like a Christmas staple. And to be fair, it's less of a recipe and more of a serving suggestion, and the suggestion is cheese. But it's two things that when I eat, when I make myself, that it's that gives me that family feeling that I assume granny's pasta mince also gives you.
Absolutely. What is your favorite Scottish word? This is so hard.
Oh.
I think I've got mine. Mine is weesht.
Weesht.
I love weesht. I also love
that's weesht. What your mum, isn't that what your mum said?
Yeah, my mum. Oh, probably actually.
Because then I said, you mean as in hodger weesht?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I've clearly been told to weesht a lot as a child. I know.
Universal family saying. What is my favourite Scottish word? Oh, do you know what it will be? Glaik it.
Glaik it, that's a good one.
If you're looking a bit glaik it, you're looking a bit passive, maybe an inference of looking a bit stupid, kind of dumbfounded. Yeah. If you're looking a bit glacid, glassy eyed.
Yeah.
Aye. Glacid.
I like wabbit as well. Like, oh, I'm a bit wabbit, like all over the place.
Mm.
But yeah, both things.
Lindsay, what is an ingredient you're always going for in the kitchen?
I mean, the thing I use the most and love the most is probably butter, but I think for me it's anchovies. Like, I always, it's either anchovy paste or like anchovies in a jar. I'm adding anchovies to stuff constantly. I just love them.
Yeah. And actually mine is adjacent, which is Lee and Perrins, which is essentially just anchovy sauce.
Anchovy sauce. Exactly. Yeah.
Everyone hates anchovies and loves Lee and Perrins. I'm sorry to tell you, you're just having a big bottle of anchovies. But it's one of these things that actually I did. I was getting really into anchovies a couple of years ago, and then I'd seen a food writer, someone chatting about just actually add more Worcestershire sauce if you're going to like deglaze a pan or whatever. And it's just something I add it to Italian, Scottish, mince, fish. Everything goes well with Lee and Perrins.
I love
at
like,
Lee and Perrins. Please sponsor season 3.
Sponsor. I love like a Heinz tomato soup with a bunch of Lee and Perrins in it, or like toasted cheese, Lee and Perrins on top. Oh,
absolutely, yeah, that's a classic. Although I would say the Worcestershire goes on the bread and then the cheese on top as a personal preference.
Oh, interesting. I'll try that next.
I find that sometimes the Lee and Perrins can like kind of, it sits on top of the cheese.
It like glides on over the fat, doesn't it? So it doesn't sink in.
But if you put it on the bread, then if you put it on the bread, then you actually get like a much greater Lee and Perrins flavor. The payoff is bigger.
Yeah.
Also has an impact on the texture of the bread because it can help to kind of hydrate as it's going underneath the grill.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's not talk about this any longer.
Oh, I'm getting hungry. Okay. Do you remember the first job you were given in the kitchen?
I mean, again, I have maybe two core memories. One is Angel Delight, the making of Angel Delight, because it's relatively like risk-free and you can be left your own devices. And my mum had this like, well, it must have been like a leftover like workout thing from the 80s. It was like a protein powder shaker that had a little like blade in it, and you just shake the Angel Delight in this.
Wow.
And the other one is like the kind of the formative memory of my gran teaching me to bake on like one Saturday morning when she was doing her baking and I'd stayed overnight at hers. And that like standing on a chair with a half wrapped up penny tied around my waist. And it was scones, meringues, shortbread, and like getting a full overview of my granny's kitchen process.
Aww,
and what about you? What was the first job you were given in the kitchen?
I again have two. One of them, it like was as a kind of yearly tradition. So every year at Christmas, we make mince pies, and my dad would make the pastry. And it was always, I think it stands out because like my dad's an amazing cook, but my mum was always the main cook just because of time. So this was one of the things we did with my dad, and we would, they were like, me and my two brothers would be sort of lined up again, just as you say, like perched on a stool or something, and we'd be in this conveyor belt of like cutting out bits of pastry, the little stars for the top, or like filling them and making the mince pies. So I like that little Christmas production line. And then again, like terribly middle class, but one of the things that I remember as a core memory that my mum kind of let me do that established some independence in the kitchen was if she was making a risotto, it was my, like, she would do the, like, fry the onion, get the rice in, make the stock, but then my job was to ladle the stock in and stir it until the risotto was done. And it was this like,
that's high octane pressure.
I found it so like, I did find it quite pressure packed, but like so soothing at the same time. And you'd be testing the rice. You couldn't serve a risotto with the rice undone. It was, I think because it was just that repeated process. And it was a really good one actually for like making me pick up on different indicators of cooking.
Yeah.
Like you could see when the rice changed color or things like came together and it started like congealing, and then you'd add more stock. So yeah, that was my main one.
Well, this is us at the end of the last episode, at the end of season 2. We will be back for a season 3 unless me and Lindsay have some sort of incredible falling out,
our artistic differences, some sort of,
or if one of us gets really famous in the next couple of months. But we do plan to be back later on in the year. We're going to take some time to have a think about our format and find some guests and develop what our season 3 theme might be. And we'll be back with some other great Scottish food stories and a few more deep dives on the great cuisine of our country.
And thank you so much to all of our guests this season. We've had the privilege of speaking to, I mean, all of our guests have been absolutely amazing. There's been some dream guests for Peter and I where we gushed, you know, very unprofessionally over people. There's been friends, there's been colleagues. It's been great. And yeah, it really made this season pop off for us, I think. So that's been a joy.
And what we will say is, while we are away, feel free to have a listen back to the catalogue. Like, rate, share, send it to your mum, send it to your gran. Help us get the word out there about our great Scots and the food that they invented.
And if any listeners have any burning suggestions or recommendations, or if you're listening and you think, you should come and speak to me because I make beautiful food on a stunning Scottish island somewhere, please hit us up.
Yes, especially if you're on a stunning Scottish island. Listen, we will see you later on in 2025. Until then, stay fed, stay warm, and I don't know what I should have thought.
Slán.
Yeah, there we go. Sláinte.